Guardian.
It's not you, it's me. Well, kind of. After 47 years in a tumultuous relationship, Britain divorces the EU. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Mr. Speaker, I wonder if you can guess what this Parliament is going to do once we put the withdrawal agreement back. We're going to get Brexit done.
3.5 years after the EU referendum, the Prime Minister formally signed the EU withdrawal agreement on Friday, paving the way for the UK to leave and taking care to have a flattering photo taken as he did so. The 31st of January will be a historic date, as the EU 28 becomes the EU 27. And despite many lamenting the way we got here, it's time to look ahead to the aftermath. So what happens now? Will Boris Johnson be able to secure the trade deal with the EU by the end of the year, as promised? Can the EU and the UK ever just be friends after such an acrimonious split? And what does the future hold for the United Kingdom? And it's not just that EU deal the PM hopes to strike. He wants to keep on just the right side of Donald Trump too, as UK officials press for a US deal. Tuesday's decision on Huawei's role in building the UK's 5G network was the first test of how difficult that could be. And meanwhile, the Labour leadership campaign rolls on. We'll hear lots more about that later in the show. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, we're 2 days away from Britain officially leaving the EU. One of the most immediate consequences of the event is a group of people losing their jobs, British MEPs. The Guardian's Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin, spoke to two who will no longer have to clock in after the 31st, both with a very different outlook on this end to an era. Starting with the former UKIP MEP and current Brexit Party MEP, Jonathan Bullock.
I think there's mixed emotions. I certainly don't regret that Britain is leaving the EU. That's been something I've campaigned for many years, and it's been up and down over the last few years, but we've managed to make it. But I think there's a sadness in terms of having worked with people for some for just a few months, but others like Nigel Farage for many years, that, you know, there'll be a missing thing about comradeship, about the things we've done together. I'm sure there'll be lots of reunions and meetings up to replicate that in the future.
And what will you miss most about being an MEP?
I've enjoyed campaigning on the issues. I've enjoyed my work with the media. I've enjoyed representing people. There's a lot of issues. You probably don't even go above the line. For example, you might be helping a constituent who's written to you because they've got had a problem in Spain. They've lost their wallet. They've got a problem, and they write to you because they're having problems with their insurance company. It's fun trying to help them and get them sorted out. So I'll actually miss helping people like that, but things move on.
And what are the things that you won't miss?
Well, I won't miss some of the travel, and not the travel to Brussels, that's not too bad, a couple of hours on the Eurostar, but certainly this idea of every 4 weeks going to Strasbourg, which takes a day travel there, a day travel back, costs not only, you know, sort of hundreds of thousands for the Parliament to do this, but of course for those who, you know, sort of look at the issues of CO2, etc. I mean, what cost is there in that in the Parliament, or changing to Strasbourg, then or changing back? I certainly won't miss that journey.
We're looking to Brexit Day itself, looking to the 31st of January. How will you be marking this day?
Well, I'll be here at the start on the 31st. It's my last day in the job, so I'll be emptying my office, sorting things out with members of staff, etc. But then I will travel over and join the celebrations in Parliament Square. You know, we've been working on this for many years. We are going to hold a party.
Well, now, Brexit is happening. The Conservative Party have taken on the agenda. I think you were a former Conservative yourself, and you will no longer be part of the European Parliament, so you'll no longer be getting the Secretariat and the resources from the European Parliament. So does the Brexit Party have a future?
I think it's watch and wait. I think we have a lot of hope that Boris Johnson will deliver, particularly on the things he said later about no alignment with the rules of the EU. He's already, of course, put into law the fact that there won't be any extension to trade deal talks beyond the end of this year. So things look positive, but we will wait and see what happens. There's a lot of issues out there, such as fishing, such as what happens with Northern Ireland, and we will be there, we will be around. I think Nigel Farage has accepted that he took his eye off the ball a few years ago when, after 2016 and the, or more, 2017, where every manifesto said they'd be implementing Brexit, we just expected it to happen, and it didn't. So I think this time we will be watching and waiting and hopefully making sure that it's delivered properly.
And what does the future hold for you personally? What would you like to do once you've stood down from the Parliament?
Well, I had a property business I'll return to, which I've sort of really been spinning the plates on, which I can get stuck into again. But as I say, I'll also be involved in campaigning and supporting those organisations have done in the past, both politically and charitable organisations I'm involved with as well. And to catch breath a bit, it's only been 2.5 years for me. It's been an absolutely fast, vigorous 2.5 years, and there'll be a time to pause and take in breath, but also to monitor what's happening with the process once we've left.
I'm Molly Scott-Cato, and I'm the Green MEP for South West England and Gibraltar.
So, Molly Scott-Cato, you became an MEP in 2014 for the Green Party, re-elected in 2019, and you've campaigned tirelessly for a second referendum, but now Brexit is happening. We're sitting in your office with the boxes packed and you're getting ready to go. How do you feel now?
Well, I campaigned for us to stay in the EU. I mean, I was totally against Brexit. It wasn't just for a second referendum of 4 years, you know, before the referendum, through the referendum, after the referendum. I'm convinced this is a disaster for Britain, so I put everything I had into it. So you can imagine I feel pretty defeated now and quite anxious for the future of the country as well. And it's just a terrible waste. It's like throwing away power. It's like being part of the most socially benign, environmentally benign power block in the world and saying, no, I think I'll just go off and kind of ask Trump for favours instead. It's absolutely ridiculous.
What are the things you'll miss from the European Parliament?
Look, when the Parliament works best, it's because we take the best from everybody's policy platform. And nobody can get a majority here without getting on with other people. And so that means that politics here is very, I'm not going to say friendly, because we have very strong disagreements, but the basis of it is that you're looking for an agreement. And that means you make friendships and, you know, relationships with people from all sorts of different countries, all sorts of different political positions, and that feels like an absolute privilege. You know, I mean, I've sat in a room with maybe 20 negotiators speaking 12 different languages themselves, you know, all of them negotiating something in English that's highly technical. It's really challenging, and I think for me, absolutely everything I am has been used by this job. And actually, I like that. I like feeling that I've been able to contribute absolutely everything. And I think to be a good MEP, you really need to, because you're always on the move. You're constantly switching between different languages or national cultures. It's really challenging, but I've really enjoyed that challenge. And my future life will not be as challenging, I'm sure.
And to switch back to this week, will you be voting against the withdrawal agreement? I understand that's the Green Party position.
Yeah, I think that the decision about whether we would leave is basically made at Westminster. And obviously I've fought it in Britain. My decision on the withdrawal agreement is about whether that's good for the future of the European Union. Is it a good deal? I mean, my job here is to represent the interests of the European Union. I was elected from Britain to do that. I would vote against it probably anyway, but in this case, my decision is based on the fact that it's a bad deal for Europe and a bad deal for Britain, obviously, for massive reasons which we don't need to go into, because I'm sure I've said them thousands of times before. So it's bad for both sides, and that's why I won't vote for it.
Do you think we'll ever see British MEPs again?
I'm sure we will. I don't think it's the time now to start some kind of rejoin movement. What I've been doing for the past 3 years is to try to prevent the country suffering the consequences of Brexit, but they now become inevitable. And I think my job is to point out that when jobs are lost in the car industry or the farmers I represent can't export their cheese or whatever the problem is that will arise, I have to make it very clear that that's the consequence of Brexit, because we're going to enter a phase now where the British government will attempt to create this betrayal narrative where it blames all those consequences on the EU and on people like me for not, you know, getting with the programme. And so that's a very clear task for me in the short term. Brexit will leave us isolated. We'll be making a choice between US, you know, with Trump in the White House, or even without Trump, a sort of very bargain basement kind of approach to economic life. or the EU, where whatever you think of the way politics works, most politicians are trying to improve things for citizens and for the environment. And if you look around the world, the highest standards are in Europe. And I think our young people will recognise that and will bring us back.
And with all those big, weighty questions in mind, how will you be spending the 31st of January?
There are a lot of big, weighty questions. I've had a very nice invitation to go and join an event in Warwick, which is with young people, and they're asking questions around, you know, what does the future look like for us in Europe and future European relationships? And so it'll be nice to be able to focus on that and try and focus on the positive. I won't be watching all the antics of the sort of triumphalist Brexiteers, and I'll have something very pleasant to do that will divert me from that. Mm-hmm. Also, I think if people are thinking about what to do, some people say they'll be hanging flags, but other people say they'll just put a candle in their window just to say, for us, you know, this is the light that we keep on, and it's our hope of going back to the EU. And to me, that's a nice, dignified symbol that you value the peace project, actually, of the European Union, and that you see that our future lies here in Europe.
That was Jennifer Rankin in Brussels there. She joins us now on the phone. And in the studio, I'm joined by Andrew Fisher, until very recently the policy director of the Labour Party, and James Kirkup, director of the Social Market Foundation. So, Jennifer, what's the mood like where you are?
The mood, of course, is as varied as British MEPs are varied. There are the Brexit Party MEPs who are really rejoicing, cheering about this moment. And then you've got a lot of very sad Labour, Lib Dem, Green MEPs, some more ambivalent Conservative MEPs. And of course, I think there's enormous sadness from the rest of the EU. There's a real sense of loss that the UK is leaving. There's a lot of sadness about this moment, and a lot of politicians from other countries have said to me how much they're going to miss the contribution of their British colleagues, although with the exception of Nigel Farage and his party, who have never been very popular in this building.
And James, the mood here seems to be that the Conservatives have sort of dialing down the triumphalism. I saw Steve Baker of the ERG yesterday saying this was a time for big hearts. Boris Johnson has apparently ordered that the word Brexit will not really be used after Friday, although they are flogging some souvenir got Brexit done tea towels, I see. I wonder how you think the Conservatives will handle this from here on in.
I think that's exactly the point. It is essentially job done, move on. I think there is an acknowledgement that getting this bit of Brexit done is a necessary but not sufficient condition for the Conservative Party fulfilling some of all of the promises it made in order to get that majority in December. So essentially do this bit, and then I think you'll see a very sudden and noisy pivot onto talking about the domestic agenda, schools, hospitals, all the rest, anything but, you know, banging on about Europe, to use David Cameron's old phrase.
And Andrew, for Labour, you know, Brexit has been this sort of torturous path through this issue, hasn't it? Mm. For a couple of years, the position evolved and evolved and evolved, and suddenly it's kind of disappeared as an issue almost. I wonder how Labour inserts itself into this conversation about Brexit over the next couple of years. Perhaps it ignores it.
I think it needs to hold the government to account. It's the opposition, obviously. So over the next few years, as James said, this is far from done. I think in terms of the debate about are we leaving, are we staying, I think that's done. And I think there'll be very little appetite within the Labour Party for people who want to rejoin. So therefore, I think it is done. And I think Labour will be quite happy to pivot onto the domestic agenda, to be honest.
And Jennifer, tell us about what isn't done. As James says, we've got this sort of symbolic moment. It's the start of something else, isn't it? And there's a very tight deadline for getting that trade deal.
Very much so, and it's almost everything to do, really, because what we've been negotiating for the last nearly 3 years has been the divorce treaty, so sorting out EU citizens' rights, the money, and then, of course, the Irish border. But now there's the whole future relationship that still has to be constructed. So, you know, at the centre of that, a new trade agreement, but then also agreements on security and police cooperation, agreements on foreign policy and cooperation on environment and climate action as well. So there's just a huge array of areas. And really, even when we talk about trade, we're only looking at the tip of the iceberg, and there's a lot of very technical details to be unwound. But expectations here are that all you can do in 11 months is a very basic free trade agreement. So that's this zero tariffs, zero quotas agreement that's been offered to the UK, but with the proviso that the UK continues to respect EU standards on workers' rights, on environment, on state subsidies. That's all the EU thinks can be done in the time available. And then they're hoping as well to do some other parts around security, but it's an enormous agenda. There'll probably be an enormous row in the summer about fishing because there's a deadline on fishing rights looming in the middle of the year, and the EU really want to get that sorted as a priority so the fishing industry know for 2021 what their rights they have to fish in British waters and vice versa. That could quite soon start to become a real sticking point in the talks that becomes a sort of a lever for or a way that sort of sucks in quite unrelated issues, because the EU would like to use leverage on the fisheries point in order to make gains on trade.
James, how much of a challenge do you think the government faces this year in trying to get these things resolved, or does it just get as much as it can done in time and then off we go?
It is both true on one hand that there is a huge amount of technical work to do and many possibly insuperable technical issues to resolve. On the other hand, the politics of this, I think, are possibly a little bit easier than some people think. I think that two things are important. One, I think the act of leaving the formal enter membership this week will see the salience of the issue drop. A lot of the heat and the passion, the public interest will come out of this issue. So it won't be the defining issue of politics, and that will give more room for manoeuvre. I also think if you think back to the events that got us to Boris Johnson making his deal, realistically, he got that deal by retreating. It was brilliantly presented as being a triumph.
Glorious retreat, yeah.
Yes, but actually, I mean, he essentially reverted to a position that Theresa May had pushed the EU away from. And he did it because he was forced into that position by the Benn Act, the Surrender Act. He surrendered to the Surrender Act, if you like. Now, but he then presented that to the Conservative Party as being a great victory. And the Conservative Party was willing to accept it as a glorious victory. Now, that makes me think that, A, that Boris Johnson is prepared to be pragmatic and to compromise, and it tells us that he is able to present his compromises as success, and it tells us his party is prepared to go along with that narrative. Now, all of that in a context where voters are a bit less bothered, are more interested in schools, hospitals, infrastructure, growth, all the rest, makes me think that there is more room for manoeuvre on the British side, and so a way can be found through some of this stuff. On all of the three level playing field issues that Jennifer just mentioned there, I think, funnily enough, employment rights, the environment, and state aid. I think state aid might be the most difficult.
I went to a Conservative press conference halfway through the election campaign, at which way they were trumpeting what would be the UK's right to bail out more companies, effectively, which seemed an odd Conservative.
Oh, but if you think about all those new Tory MPs in the Red Wall and further north, if you think about the political imperative on the new political imperative on the Conservative Party, it's not going to be a Conservative Party where the libertarian free marketeers who deregulate and build Singapore on the sea have the upper hand here. I mean, it is a party that is going to need to do things that appeal to and keep on side the people of Redcar and the rest. And so a different approach to state aid and industrial strategy is going to be quite important there.
Do you think that's right, Andrew?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think as well, it's often underestimated by both sides of the debate as well, how much flexibility the UK's actually got that it doesn't use on state aid. I mean, other countries like Germany and France make a lot more use of EU state aid rules to give money to companies. Italy bailed out its steel industry not long ago whilst I think Redcar was collapsing here. So there's a whole different kind of culture in other European countries, basically because they've got an industrial strategy, which Britain hasn't had for 40 years and is going to need to have very, very quickly, depending on how we leave. And I think Boris will compromise again, because the salience of the issue and the willingness of his party to compromise means they will get a deal that's fairly close to the EU and forego the kind of, Steve Baker dream of a US free market trade deal, and Marc Francois, I guess, those sort of types.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. But we've lots more to talk about after the break, including what Britain might end up looking like after Brexit, and whether or not the Labour leadership candidates are focusing on the right issues facing the party during this campaign. More on that after the break.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton, and this is Football Weekly. We cover the football, all the football, from the serious...
It was the most cowardly, disgusting press conference I've ever seen.
For the analysis,
when you put them into the actual games, Liverpool are getting more points against XG than Leicester.
To the nonsense.
And I will be having £5 on him to be called a bootner.
What?
What?
Christian Benteke?
Listen to Football Weekly from The Guardian on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. So one of the early decisions Johnson has had to take in terms of leaning towards one pole or the other, Europe or the US, is the involvement of Huawei in the 5G and full fibre network, as I learned yesterday, I should be calling it, at a briefing I tried to continue to follow. What does this tell us, Andrew, do you think? I mean, to some extent, is it a determination to face down Donald Trump, I suppose? Although I think British officials suggest they didn't have very much choice unless they were willing to delay 5G, which they're not very happy about.
I mean, I feel your pain, first of all, because obviously during the election, we rolled out a plan for
full fibre,
universal full fibre broadband.
Quite the thing, yeah.
So I had to get up to speed pretty quickly on that as well. But I think the decision was pragmatic. Whether it's right or wrong on security grounds is a different question, but I think it's pragmatic in the sense that there are very few companies that have the ability to do this. And what our policy in the election was trying to do is say, look, we haven't got this. We're giving it to various companies in Britain that are not doing this very efficiently. The rollout of full fibre broadband, let alone getting onto 5G, is pretty poor. It's pretty inefficient. The government's subsidising it. It's not working very well. And there's a far more efficient way of doing this, which involves taking a stake in the government, driving it to build up that expertise, which doesn't exist, which is why they've had to go to Huawei or Huawei or however you say it. But I think that's the issue, is that they want to do this, and this is a kind of probably the quickest way of doing it, whether there are downsides to that or not.
It was quite interesting that the tone of yesterday's briefing was, you know, it's our intention to try and create a more diversified market. And actually, we might be willing to use some public money to do that. You know, let's partner with the US, potentially let's invest some money in the next generation, which is a little bit towards what Labour was talking about, state involvement, perhaps, in the private sector. I don't know. James, what did you think about the decision?
I think, pragmatic is about right. I mean, it adds to the argument, those who argue that Boris Johnson's instinct on complicated questions is to split the difference and try and avoid upsetting people where he can. Obviously, they've gone ahead with this despite knowing that the US is strongly opposed. There's a reasonable counter to that, which is, what is the alternative? I mean, this is ultimately a story about long-term shift in global power and technological primacy that you. But the fact that they've gone ahead with as many caveats as possible. You see, all the messaging today is about the market share limits, the reductions, the restrictions, essentially trying to strike a bit of a balance. I think politically speaking, is it that bad a thing at the moment in the short term to be seen to be differing, diverging from Donald Trump? We saw quite a lot of attempts during the election campaign to depict Boris Johnson as being the creature of the ally of Donald Trump. And now, hey, here you go. You've got a public disagreement on something that will, in retail terms, deliver something
the public
the public wants and doesn't really care how it's delivered. Alone. This week, it's probably a relatively sensible, pragmatic, cautious decision.
Jennifer, I wonder how closely decisions like these are being watched in the EU, which presumably is also trying to come to terms with what kind of government this is, what kind of Britain this is.
Yes, and of course the EU is making its own decisions on 5G, and the European Commission today is also putting forward its proposal. It's saying that it doesn't want a blanket ban on Huawei. It wants to leave member states sort of room for discretion. So in a way, the position that the Commission is recommending for its member states is very similar to the line the British government have chosen. And of course, that position that the Commission have drawn up was actually very influenced by the UK. The UK ambassador was one of the 28 who was sitting around the table hammering out the EU's approach to China. Only 1 year ago, the EU labelled China a strategic threat, and that was a verdict very much of all 28. So I think it shows there is still a great deal of common ground, and you see that on other issues such as the Iran nuclear deal. Well, I mean, despite Boris Johnson's talking more favourably of a Trump deal, but nonetheless, the UK and the EU have been much closer on all sorts of foreign policy issues. And I think they will try to sort of maintain those links after Brexit, and potentially that will be one of the sort of easier parts of the future relationship to agree, because the UK still does have a good deal of foreign policy heft with its permanent seat at the UN Security Council. But people will be watching incredibly closely what the UK does next. And there is a lot of concern about the UK leaning more into a US model, especially when it comes to economic standards. And that's why, going back to what we were talking about earlier on trade, it won't just be a choice that the UK might have to make between the US and China. It will also be a choice between the US and Europe, because as the government is trying to reach a trade deal with the EU, it will also be in talks with the US. And that will be a very difficult balancing act, especially when you have a huge amount of concern in the EU that the UK could become a backdoor for all sorts of products that they don't want to see in their market, the famous chlorinated chickens, which has really become so totemic, because it's really a shorthand for US farm standards that the EU just thinks are not good enough, and a model of farming the EU doesn't want. So I think there are some very fundamental choices as well coming down the line.
I think it's really since the end of the Second World War and the decolonization and the end of the British Empire, I think Britain has tried to see itself as this kind of bridge between Europe and the US, with differing levels of effect at different times. But I mean, I think that has been kind of the Foreign Office orthodoxy post Second World War, really, that Britain does play that role. So I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson tries to play that role even now. And I think, you know, I think the trade issue is going to be the pivotal one. My guess is we'll end up being much closer to the EU than the US. But if we do, then it creates opportunities for his political opponents, because for all the reasons, whether that's steel, whether that's food standards, whether that's workers' rights and environmental rights, there are huge differences. And actually, there are probably as many differences, if not more, between the EU and the US on trading standards as there are between the US and China, to be honest.
Another thing looming on the domestic agenda is Scottish independence, isn't it, James? Which is bubbling up. You know, it's a chart. We're talking about Britain's place in the world.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I speak as a former political editor of The Scotsman. I'm disturbed by how little engagement there is with that subject at Westminster across the board. And obviously, we've had the initial skirmish, Boris Johnson rejecting Nicola Sturgeon's request for a referendum. And the thing that really alarms me is the number of people I've spoken to in all parties who essentially say, well, take the view that that's that settled then. The government of London has said there's been a referendum, and it doesn't work like that. I mean, yes, the legal authority for a referendum rests in London, but the political reality is, particularly if the SNP do win and win substantially next year, and who'd bet against them, it seems inevitable that there will be another referendum. And I don't know if the organisation and if the argument, if the will is there on the pro-union side to win again, particularly in the context of a United Kingdom that has left the European Union. And that will add to the SNP nationalist argument that actually maybe if we now jump off this bandwagon being driven by Boris Johnson, who is not a popular man in Scotland, then maybe there is a future for an independent Scotland to really affiliate in some way, shape or form to the European Union. So I know obviously we come into this parliament thinking Brexit is the thing. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of it we actually think that the defining event moment theme of this parliament is the union.
Andrew, do you think that's right? Labour got pretty brutally squeezed in Scotland, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Labour's never really recovered since 2014 after the Better Together campaign, I think. We were down to one MP in 2015. We had a brief surge to seven in 2017,
surge.
And then back to one. I did use the term ironically. 2019, back down to one again. So yeah, Labour is not doing well in Scotland. But I think in terms of the question of Scottish independence, I think it will depend on, one, what sort of Brexit deal Boris Johnson gets. That will give renewed impetus to public opinion in Scotland. If it's a more distant relationship that Scotland thinks will do it damage. And I think the second thing is what happens with the Alex Salmond trial and what revelations come out of that. I'm not going to speculate on that, but yeah, I mean, James is right. You wouldn't bet against the SNP doing well in Scotland in 2021 just based on the last five or six years?
I think there's some, some difficult questions for both the big UK parties. I mean, certainly, I am struck by how few Conservatives remember the fact that the proper name of their party, the Conservative Unionist Party. I mean, there is occasionally lurking in the background somewhere, but, you know, the Conservative Party, some people were wondering, well, actually, you know what? Would it be such a terrible thing if we lost a country that tends to return non-Tory MPs? And I'm not saying that's the prominent view. And obviously, there's a lot of talk in Scottish Labour about whether or not London Labour threw the party under the bus during the campaign. I mean, committed is Labour in its current form to the union, do you think?
I think it is. I think the overwhelming opinion within Labour and Scottish Labour is for Scotland to remain part of the UK, but in a more with more powers, probably, I think, is the consensus than it has now. If there is a renewed mandate from the Scottish Parliament in 2021, it wouldn't be democratic for Westminster to block that. You know, if the SNP won, you know, overwhelmingly in 2021 in the Scottish parliamentary elections, then for Westminster to say, no, we're going to ignore that, especially in the context of Brexit, you know, things have materially changed since the 2014 referendum, I think it would be legitimate. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable and democratic argument, even though I think Scottish Labour and the Labour Party would be passionately for saying...
I think that's true. Remain. Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. And it's almost a statement of fact. But I think it's a different thing for, you know, people run this table to say that's a statement of fact to someone who is a participant in politics to say that. I think because the way that that plays, having a senior, a prospective Labour leader say, you know what, if you vote for the SNP next year, you'll get a referendum, that has political consequences. And that's what I'm intrigued by. I don't pass comments on it. I just think I think that's, again, one of these things that is not necessarily being properly analysed and talked about enough in the warm and tropical metropolitan south.
Jennifer, I'm keen to talk more about Labour since we have Andrew here, but just to ask, how easy would it be for Scotland to re-enter, to somehow, you know, become one of those small EU member states?
There is a path, and you have SNP MEPs here who have been, you know, lighting candles and leaving that message that they hope to return one day as an independent country. But I think that it would be a long path, and we've hit a huge number of obstacles really politically in the UK, because while Brexit does bolster Nicola Sturgeon's political argument about why Scotland should be independent, it does seem to weaken the economic case for it, because then you'd be asking Scotland to leave the UK single market, you'd be asking Scotland to leave the pound, because all new member states are expected to join the euro. These hurdles that to me look to be the real barriers, but I think if in the theoretical situation you had got over that, then I think then of Scotland could apply to rejoin the EU, and that would happen. And people in Brussels have sounded more favourable to the possibility of Scotland joining as an independent country in a way that they didn't before Brexit, because the EU is a club of member states, a club of national governments, and generally doesn't like separatist movements, whether that's Flanders, Catalonia or Scotland. But I think there is more sympathy for the case now from Scotland, but it does seem that given the huge sort of economic turmoil it would throw Scotland into, I think it looks less likely.
Let's talk a bit more about Labour. We talked about Labour in Scotland there. Andrew, there's obviously a leadership election going on, and part of what's happening in that leadership election is everyone's talking about their own particular version of why Labour lost the December election. It seems the NEC, the party's ruling body, got a paper yesterday that said it's all about the Brexit. That was really, you know, the driving cause of it. And that's obviously a strongly held view in some bits of the party. I wonder what your feeling is after you've had a little bit of time to reflect. Yeah.
I think Labour's problem is much bigger than that. And I think anyone who wants to hold a comfort blanket that says it's Jeremy Corbyn or it's Brexit is doing exactly that, holding a comfort blanket. They're not really analysing the real reasons. Labour's lost four elections. Now, you can pin the last two on Jeremy Corbyn, but the one before last was the only election since 1997 where Labour's gained seats in an election. Every election since then, bar 2017, Labour has lost seats. You know, that is a pretty dire trajectory that Labour's been on. And I think, you know, there needs to be a lot deeper reflection. I mean, the way people have described the Brexit issue is it's because we moved to a second referendum. And actually, I think it's, even though I think Brexit was a factor, it's not necessarily the biggest factor either, but it was definitely a factor. It wasn't just that. It was deeper than that. It was about the way that Brexit divided the electorate. In the same way that Scottish independence divided the electorate there, it wasn't about whether Labour campaigned for yes or no in 2014. It was about how it did, in a sense, but also it just polarised the electorate in a way that Labour was never going to be the most pro-Remain party, and it was never going to be the most pro-Leave party, and therefore it kind of got a bit caught in it. And bizarrely, having, you know, become political in the kind of early 90s when the Tory party was ripping itself apart over Europe, in a sense, nowhere near that scale, to be fair, Labour became quite a divided party on Europe, and not necessarily on Europe, but on Brexit. I mean, I think it's good for Labour that Brexit will cease to be an issue to a large extent after the 31st of January. But I think it was much, much deeper than that. And the trends of where Labour is gaining and losing seats and the shift in the electorate is much deeper, and something Labour's got to contend with if it's going to win back power. You know, platitudes about Brexit or Jeremy Corbyn are not going to solve this.
And how existential do you think are those questions for Labour? I mean, our columnist John Harris did a piece earlier in the week saying he felt a lot of these questions, you know, about what is Labour's electoral coalition, what's it for, are not really being addressed in the leadership contest, where everyone seems to be being quite careful.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it is existential at this point, but I think if we keep kind of comforting ourselves with simplistic answers, it will become so, because you have to address those things. And I don't have all the answers. I'm not about to reveal the solution here, but I think it does need a bit of debate, insight, serious discussion, which I hope the leadership campaign, and it's still got a long way to go, over 2 months to go, can kind of, you know, begin to start that discussion. But I do worry that there's a kind of, it's become factionalised. One side saying it's all Brexit and throwing kind of the Keir Starmer, Emily Thornberry wing under a bus, and the other side saying it's all Jeremy Corbyn to try and, you know, rid the party of the last vestiges of Corbynism. You know, I think that would be a mistake on either side to do that.
I wonder whether part of it's about optimism too. I mean, I interviewed Rebecca Long-Bailey last week, and she was saying, she uses this word aspirational all the time, doesn't she? You know, when she sort of spoke to aspirational voters, they felt Labour's about handouts. You know, I've done very well for myself, thanks. I don't want handouts. You know, I might agree with the diagnosis, but Labour was offering you statism, and that it was a bit kind of pessimistic about the state of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I read that interview that you did with her, and I think, you know, that kind of experience is very similar to an experience Tony Blair cited in the run-up to 92, actually, where I think there was a perception, and I think that's what Rebecca was saying, that Labour was not for middle-income people who are doing okay, have got a mortgage, are not kind of in arrears with it, perhaps a bit above middle-income, but, you know, not the super rich either, and that Labour wasn't for them. And I think there is a perception that Labour talked about, you know, homelessness, poverty, inequality and those sort of things, but didn't talk about what we were doing for the country, how we proposed to transform the country would benefit those sort of people. And I think we have to capture that. You know, politics in Britain, especially with our electoral system first past the post, is about building a coalition that spreads across boundaries. The Tories have had to. I mean, you know, they have policies that tend to benefit the top 5 or 10%, if that, and somehow have to convince a much bigger swathe of the population that actually, no, this is in your interest too. And, you know, they've been very effective at doing that. Labour, you know, genuinely does tend to have policies when they're analysed by, you know, fairly neutral academics that will benefit the majority of the population, and yet, you know, conspires to lose more than it wins. And that's, you know, an historic thing. I'm not just talking about the last two elections. So I think what Becky's saying is right. And I quite like the phrase aspirational socialism. I'm drawn to it, but it needs to be filled out. And I think that's true of a lot of the Labour candidates. They've all got their little pitches that are quite soundbitey at this point. And I think a lot of members are probably waiting to be convinced that there's substance behind all of it. And that applies to people saying, you know, end factionalism or build a red bridge, you know, like, okay, how? And how do you achieve that? And what's the link? What are the policies that do that? What are the campaigns? What's the emphasis that does that? You know, I think that is true of all three of them at this point. And maybe that will be, I hope that will be teased out. And, you know, hopefully, you know, meritocratically, the winner will be the person who does kind of fill out, you know, their kind of soundbite at the moment.
We could probably talk about the future of Labour Party for quite a lot longer. But before we go, this is a historic week. How are you all marking Friday evening, if at all? James, have you purchased your souvenir to tell?
I have not really. I've made no great plans, terribly enough. I'm probably do what I do most evenings, which is you try and read more than 3 pages of book before falling asleep, because that's sort of rock and roll lifestyle I lead, really.
Andrew, is that your plan?
That sounds familiar. I'm going to combine that with a bit of Long Baileyism, I'm afraid, except with one important difference. It'll be Netflix and a curry for me, rather than Netflix and a
curry. Very nice. I think I might be with you, although I'm unclear whether I'm actually going to have to report on the exciting events in Parliament Square. Jennifer, will you be marking the occasion at all?
Well, potentially in the reporting sense of flag watching, watching the European Union flag come down from the UK representation around dusk on Friday, and then maybe sort of keeping an eye out for the other very low key moments that will be happening in Brussels. But people here really don't want to celebrate this, so I think I'll be doing some keeping an eye on what's going on, and otherwise having a quiet night.
Right, well, it's the end of an era, and presumably therefore the beginning of a new one, though it remains to be seen what that will look like from the British perspective. For anyone wanting to hear more about Britain's relationship with Europe before Brexit, listen to today's episode of Today in Focus, where Anoushka Astana chats to former Brussels correspondent for The Guardian, John Palmer. Just search for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. But that's all from us now this week. My thanks to all of our guests, Jennifer Rankin, Andrew Fisher and James Kirkup. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.